Dharma talk as a new student is all these years of experience in here. So I wonder what I have to talk about. I'm going to talk from my experience. I titled the talk The Impossibility of Zazen, but I think more accurately, maybe I should call it The Impossibility of Doing Zazen. As someone new, I tended to focus on the mechanics of Zazen, you know, posture, breathing, all that sort of stuff. In fact, I even got Zazen instruction. I know that Mike's careful about calling it meditation instruction, but other places, Tassajara, San Francisco Zen Center, and other places call it Zazen instruction. So you go in for Zazen instruction, and you know, they say, you know, you bow here, you bow there, and you sit, and you concentrate on your posture, and maybe you follow your breath, and that's Zazen instruction. But that's like, for me anyway, that's like a piano teacher saying, hey, come over here, sit on this bench, and put your feet on the ground. There are three pedals here, you can press them when you want to. You put your hands on the keys, you can press them individually or in unison. Okay, you've had piano instruction, now play. And that just doesn't, it doesn't work. You know, it just it isn't working for me to start from that place. Zen is really weird in that it starts at the end. It presupposes enlightenment. You know, it's not something you, in a sense, work towards. It's already there. So it's already a little complicated for me anyway to, you know, start like I'm already enlightened. That's, you know, and yeah, you know, you already have it. You don't, there's nothing to achieve. There's nothing to get, you already have it. I mean, I've heard that. If I had a nickel for every time I heard them say that, I mean, you know, sometimes I really would love to have some kind of good old-fashioned Vipassana meditation where, you know, they sort of take you by the hand and kind of lead you towards a goal in a way. That would be comforting, and I would sort of understand that, but it doesn't seem to be what Zen is about. Zen gives us this wonderful concept called Shikantaza, which I could be wrong about the etymology of it, but it's like, I don't know, Shikin means aware. That part of Shikantaza, Mike?
Means just, only, or only for itself.
Okay, so only for itself, you're sitting. It's sort of a concentrated awareness where you're actually not really doing anything. Of course, you're actually doing things all the time, but you're not doing things. You're just sitting there. We were talking about this. We're sitting there until you... You know, ta means hit, za means sit. And it's sort of like, somebody said the other day, it's like sitting there until you're hit with it, whatever it might be. So that's zazen. And so what I do in zazen is probably meditate. Sometimes I meditate, sometimes I daydream. I follow my breath. And sometimes I'm sitting there and I'm wondering, what am I really doing here? I'm sitting facing a wall. I'm breathing in and out. Maybe I'm meditating. What I'm really doing, I think, is projecting my awareness out there. There's the wall, and I'm looking at the wall. And frequently, I don't know about you, frequently in Zazen, I find myself about 2 feet outside my body very often. I'm thinking, well, I'm out there. I'm not feeling anything here. I mean, I have thoughts coming through. I'm noticing the wall. So maybe I should try to locate in my body. So I'll start a body scan, you know, and I'll follow my breath, and that's just not enough. And I start feeling the back of my neck, my elbows, my feet, my chest, my heart. So I'm actually aware of my heart. Actually, I'm not really aware of my heart. I mean, how can you be aware of your heart? I mean, I might be able to feel the sensations on my skin. I could feel the pulse. Sometimes I can feel the pulse in parts of my body. But to bring my attention to my heart, I don't know about that. That, to me, is really creating an image. It's really another projection of my awareness into what I have seen pictures of and thought about and heard people discuss a heart is. It's really a creative act right there. In a session, the last session I think I was in, the teacher was talking in the tea talk, and she said, bring your attention to your mudra. And I said, what? Bring your attention to your mudra. So, I'm bringing my attention to my mudra. But you see, I know what a mudra looks like. I've seen a mudra. I know the conception of a mudra. Honestly, I can feel my hands a little bit. But I'm projecting mudra. I mean, mudra is a concept in my mind. As far as real attention to something called a mudra, I don't have it. I have this idea of mudra, and I'm bringing my attention to this idea of mudra, which isn't mudra. I just feel like concentrating on this conception of mudra could be very good meditation, you know, focused mind, slow my breathing, thoughts disappear, but I don't think it's Zazen. Angie talked about in the last session, she told a story by the writer, a doctor and writer, Oliver Sacks, who some of you might know. He writes books about weird things that happen to people's brains. He wrote a book called The Man Who Thought He Was a Hat, or something like that.
The man who mistook his wife for a hat.
Even better. So she told this story about Oliver was a young boy in World War II, and he was in London during the Blitz. And he had this memory being, I think, outside his house or perhaps looking through the window of his house and seeing an incendiary bomb explode in the field next to his house or in the lot next to his house. You know, and he remembered the fire and the heat and the noise and the people that were around. He had a very vivid memory of this. And he carried this memory for all of his life, basically. And he remembered his family being there. And so when he was in his late 50s, he actually brought it up for the first time to his brother. He says, you remember when that incendiary bomb went off and all this stuff happened? And his brother looked at him and he said, you weren't there. And Oliver Sacks did not see the incendiary bomb blow up. He wasn't there. It was a completely manufactured memory that he had made up through family stories and whatever. But he had no conception that this was not something he experienced. So I bring that up as another example of the tenuousness of what we think is real. And also as an example of how I feel we project our own reality onto things, our own idea of reality onto things. Like, for instance, Greg. I see Greg, but I don't really see Greg. I see my version of Greg. And I do believe that all of you have your own versions of Greg, and probably Greg has a version of Greg. And I don't think any of these would really be the same. Do I know Greg? Like I said, I know a version of Greg. I know my version of Greg. You probably know your version of Greg, or maybe you don't. So they say you project, you create your own reality. You've heard that New Age kind of thing. And I do feel like you do that. And you're doing that in Zazen. I had an amazing experience with in a compassion class I took with a fellow who used to be here named Gonzalo. And he did this sort of thought meditation experiment. It was really fantastic. He asked us to close our eyes. And he said, imagine you are in a familiar place in a city or a town that you know. It's a nice day. You're standing there and everything's right. And you notice a friend of yours, a very good friend of yours, walking down the other side of the street. And so you wave and you smile, and that friend doesn't respond at all. He walks by you, or she walks by you, and just goes down the street, and you're left there like, what happened? And a lot of us had really interesting experiences. When I opened my eyes, my pulse was going faster, my body had heated up, I was a little bit upset. I had created my own story about what happened with this friend of mine. And I was a little bit agitated, as were many of the other students in this class. I had a big experience there that didn't exist, really. I opened my eyes and I realized I had just been sitting in a room in Palo Alto, a nice room, a yoga room, with like 14 or 15 other people. Very comfortably sitting, very soft-spoken, nice-voiced teacher. And I'm all messed up. I'm just, why did he ignore me? Did he ignore me? Or did he not see me? I don't know, but I think he ignored me. Oh, man. So I really am, you know, at a point where I don't really trust anything. And that really comes up big time in Zazen for me. So the natural extension to all this is to ask about perhaps the very conception of myself is a projection. You know, I'm projecting everything. I think I know myself, but I wonder if I do. You know, I know I have this conception of Chris. You know, it's composed of feelings, thoughts, emotions, experiences. Is it really me? I think I know a version of myself. I'm not sure it's any more than another projection. I experience my own feelings, my own thoughts, my own history, and my own memories. My aversions and my attractions, my confusions. And from all of that, I create an image. And I think I create a projection that is an interpretation of all of these phenomena. And I name it Chris. I'm not sure I really see myself like I don't really see you. And I'm not sure I really see anything else either. And in in Zazen, in sitting there, this stuff comes up big time for me. Because I see what I've been taught to see, basically. And in Zazen, you know, not just the Zazen instruction, but my entire life has taught me to see a world in a certain way. And it's no different when I'm sitting in Zazen. So pure awareness in Zazen isn't pure awareness for me. For me, and I can only speak from my experience, which is pretty, really new, Zazen is a creative process, like everything else. I don't think it's really related to knowing or awareness, whatever knowing or awareness means. When I've had these thoughts, it's reminded me of a book I read called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain or With the Right Side of the Brain. Maybe you guys know it. It's an instruction book on teaching people who don't know, or actually people who think they know about drawing, how to draw. And it's pretty interesting because, it starts off with a couple of exercises. You like page 4 or something like that, they have a line drawing of a straight back chair, very much like the chair that Greg's sitting on. You know, it's very simply drawn with a couple of slats across, right angles. And they say, okay, so here's a pretty simple drawing of a chair, so why don't you attempt to draw it? So I get my pencil and paper out, and I'm looking at the chair, and I'm drawing it as careful as I can. And remember, it's really simple. And so when I get done, you know, you look at it, and you look at what you're drawing, and you look back, and you say, it sort of looks, it's like, it's very chair-like, what I drew. It's not particularly like that chair, but I think someone could recognize it as a chair. But like if that chair had gone and robbed a bank, and there was you got to the police station, and there was a row of chairs you had to pick out. You know, my chair wouldn't fool anybody. So it's nothing like the original chair. So that's the first exercise. So then you turn the page, and there's an incomprehensible jumble of lines. I mean, you can't make any sense out of it. And they say, okay, so here's this incomprehensible jumble of lines. Draw it. So, okay, I'll do my best. So I'm drawing it, and I see a line here, and I draw that line, and I have no clue what I'm drawing or anything. In fact, it's so incomprehensible, I don't even try to understand what I'm drawing. And I draw this, and I draw that, and I draw the other thing. So I'm done. And to me, just like the chair, it sort of looks, they look the same to me. So the next instruction is, turn the book upside down. So you turn the book upside down, and you see a perfect line drawing of Igor Stravinsky sitting in a rocking chair, very relaxed, wearing a suit. I think he has a bow tie, I'm not exactly sure. Maybe he has a monocle, I don't really remember the details. But it's a really awesome drawing of Igor Stravinsky. Anyone could recognize Igor Stravinsky if they've seen him. They could recognize the rocking chair as well. And so, wow, that is weird. I would have never guessed that. And they say, turn your page over. So you turn your page over. Holy crap, it looks just like Igor Stravinsky. It's amazing. I made this amazing drawing, Igor Stravinsky sitting in a rocking chair. It was pretty amazing. I recommend you check that out. And I think the reason, and I don't remember, I mean, I have a short attention span. I don't think I really went much further in the book than that. But I do believe that the reason I was successful is because my idea of what Igor Stravinsky was or looked like didn't get in the way of my drawing Igor Stravinsky. You know, I was copying something that I did not put a name to. I did not have a thought, a feeling about, a conception about. I probably did, but not to the degree I would if I had actually, you know, seen a photograph of Igor Stravinsky. I wasn't really able to, it was outside my experience and understanding, this jumble of lines. And I was not able to project the idea of Igor Stravinsky, you know, onto my page to screw things up, basically. So I was able to draw Igor Stravinsky because I didn't know it was Igor Stravinsky. In a sense, I didn't know what I was doing when I drew Igor Stravinsky. I had no clue. I guess she's saying that in order to really draw accurately, you have to see just differently. Or rather, you have to not see in the conventional sense, or in the sense that you've been taught to see. And I feel it's the same in Zazen. I posit that you don't do Zazen. You can sit in there and you can project to your heart's content all kinds of stuff. Maybe you're meditating, but I don't think that that is Zazen. It's like this. When you sit and you hear a bird call, you think bird call. That's not a bird call. There's a sound. You've named it. You've conceptualized it. You probably had a pleasant or an unpleasant feeling about it. Whatever it was, you've altered it big time. It is not it anymore. It's an idea you've created. When you sit and you hear a bird call and you don't think that's a bird call, then that's a bird call. And that's Zazen. But you can't do it. In fact, I challenge any of you to sit and deliberately listen to a bird call and not have the thought, bird call. I don't think you can do it. Well, what are you listening for? Bird call. There, you've lost it. It's not possible. It's the same with Zazen. No matter how hard you try to do Zazen, you aren't. Maybe you're meditating, you're daydreaming. That's fine. Zen's like, you know, keep doing it. Zen's like AA, keep coming back. You know, just keep coming back. Keep coming back, not doing Zazen. Come back every day and don't do Zazen. And I suppose with enough not doing Zazen, there might be Zazen. I'm not sure. So, why do I bother coming? You know, I hear people say, oh, I want to be enlightened. Oh, I want Buddha mind. I mean, it's like talking about an alternate universe. You just have an idea in your head. You don't have a clue on what you're talking about. I look around with some people I have seen doing Zazen, and they have something that is attractive to me. They have an equanimity, a patience, a compassion, things that I want. So it seemed to work for them, so I'll keep doing zazen. So it's it's total bullshit reason for doing zazen. It's completely, I just believe that it's going to work because I see it with these other people. But that's why I do it. So I'm going to end at the beginning. I'll quote Suzuki Roshi. It's a quote that's really been a comfort to me, and I really like it because it seems to contradict the very common Zen idea of no self. Because I just like to stir things up, and Suzuki Roshi said it, so you know it's true. Anyway, so this is where I start from all the time. I start from here all the time because there's a little bit of a reason of being here, doing zazen, of not liking self. You know, like I'm going to do zazen, I'm going to be a better person, or I'm going to change, or I'm going to do something like that. So I'm starting from really not a very good place to start something like zazen. So I'm aware of that. And so when I read this quote by Suzuki Roshi, it really spoke to me. He said, "How can you practice zazen? Only when you accept yourself and when you really know that you exist here. You cannot escape from yourself. This is the ultimate fact that I am here." If you would all like to have a discussion amongst yourselves, I can speak from my own experience, but I don't have any big answers. So,
I put forth a few answers to some of the things that what you were talking about seemed to bring up. I've been doing zazen since I was a teenager, so I've been doing it a long time. And I also went and was doing had a guru and was doing a very powerful, something a lot more Raja Yoga or Kundalini Yoga, a lot more powerful than just zazen. But zazen integrally really is that. People don't realize it. What was the Buddha doing? How did Buddha get enlightenment? Oh, yeah, okay, back to India. So you're right, zazen is a process that'll create a change. It's a like a catalyst, I guess, like fire is a catalyst for oxidizing material very quickly. And in the West in particular, we really suffer from, actually the truth is all over the world, everything, people are living in their heads, they're living conceptually. And someone who could really tell you about this is Nisargadatta. You've probably heard, read his book, I Am That. He's got maybe some other books. Really is a guru in India who's died in the early 90s, I think. I didn't meet him, but I'm just talking about it. So he really nails down the whole thing. You're living just in concepts. It's conceptual. And also Papaji, who was a guru, his guru was Ramana Maharshi. Papaji died only not too long ago. 10 years ago or more, and we're always in this. That's where we're coming out of. That's what you're talking about. I see my version. It's all conceptual. You're right. Everyone all over the world, in the West, it's particularly conceptual in our culture, what we grow up with. What zazen will do, if you're patient, if you have, you're dedicated enough, if you really are patient and you really keep thorough and keep going at it, it is a process that will shut off your mind, your conceptual mind, So in one sense, it's not, you do need that conceptual mind, but to function, but it will shut that off so that you're just existing without that yama-yama and that filter, that concept, just experiencing the moment. Usually for me, it would only happen when I did intense periods of meditation, especially during sesshins. It was a lot harder to get back to that place so quickly without things like that. So yes, it will work, but it takes a lot of dedication, and it takes perhaps the right environment, maybe a sesshin or something. There are other ways to get there as well. The point is, and also I think just about every tradition says, once you get there, don't worry about the technique. So if you get there spontaneously, just walking down the road, you got it. Don't worry about having the technique. It'll start coming. You're attracting it by going after it. It'll start coming into your life where the mind is shut off. It's the concepts are gone, and you're just experiencing what's really there. In a prajna mind, I guess, the wisdom mind. You could say your intuitive self. And we come from an old monastic tradition, and none of us are living in monasteries. So that's another thing that's a little, the whole thing still works, but I'm just saying it's displaced. It's here now where we are in the 20th century. We're not living in agrarian society where things are slower. Anyway, that's probably all I can think of right now. So,
Thank you.
It seems to me that the way that I interpret something like that, because there are a lot of things that he says like that are similar to that I've encountered. It seems to me that he's trying to cultivate, and I'm not certain of this or anything, but it seems to me he's cultivating like what you're talking about with the bird. So if we have this response to ourselves, like I don't like myself or I like myself, it seems to me that like you're cultivating. Like an idea about it. Like there's this thing Suzuki said. I think some of you are trying too hard to be good Zen students. I think he said that once, and I really like that because we get like too attached to this. So there's one. There's a. There's this chanting I practice at Santa Cruz. There's a chant that goes, I forget the name of it, but if you try to stop activity through, I can't remember the chant exactly, but try to stop activity through passivity, you're just going to create more activity or something like that. Yeah,
your very effort fills you with more activity.
Besides the kind of polarity or duality of non-conception and conception, non-conception traditionally is sometimes called bare attention, where just hearing is just hearing, seeing is just seeing, and there's no labeling or no commentator, like you said, no assessing. I think that beyond those two, that we can see these two poles, I think something else that we also experience sometimes in practice and sometimes in daily life is there's a kind of a blending or an incremental part where there may be conceptualization or just, provisional or necessary conceptualization to kind of be in your body or to be conscious with a with a kind of working sense of identity, but it's not held too tightly, or it's not grasped. I think if people that have sat Sesshin experiences that, yes, there's still conceptualization going on, there's still labeling, but it's kind of, it can become very soft, or it can become almost transparent. Almost like it's still there, there's still the labeling, but it's almost like you can see through it. And seeing through it, you can feel the base, of that non-conceptual base, that where there's no names, there's no perceptor, as well as nothing to perceive. There's just as it isness. So I think that can be, in the midst of labeling and knowing and conceptualizing, that can still be experienced to some degree. I think that happens sometimes.
It's
very subtle.
The more you do this, the more that state, for me and other people, automatically comes back during the day at different times. You feel it. You're in that. You're sort of out of the conceptuals for very lightly. It has an influence. It's not an either on or off. I mean, if you keep doing it.
Could you read that quote by Fugiroshi again?
How can you practice Zazen? Only when you accept yourself and when you really know that you exist here. You cannot escape from yourself. This is the ultimate fact, that I am here.
Yeah, that struck what leapt into my mind. Well, where is here?
In the now.
Yeah, where is the now? In the now, you know, it's be in the present. Well, how long does that last?
For eternity.
It's an infinitesimal, isn't it? Where you talk about, you know, your projecting people and yourself, do you really know yourself? And most of what we gather about ourselves are memories, and then most of the time, I think we project ourselves. It's kind of like all we are. It's a projection of self in the future, plans, what we're going to do, what we're going to provide for ourselves and our loved ones. You know, engage in political action, or you know, all kinds of. But it seems like a very weak, almost ridiculous, which is why it may seem silly to say, to try to ground yourself in an infinitesimal moment, that the self could be found there, and. And of course, in one sense, they would say there is no self; it can't be found there. It has no, you know, abode. There's no substantial self. But one thing I know I've experienced many times, and it says she's definitely not sitting like this. I remember one person he walked in with thinks of it more as calisthenics. Or longer sitting, and that's too extreme. But when you do lots and lots of sitting, it will seem strange at first, and even in the beginnings of Sesshin. I remember COVID one time saying, I kind of don't know what I'm doing here. It was first or second day. But after, or at some point, it will seem your other kind of life is strange. It was like, what was I doing? I was running around, going after this and going after that, and worrying, and everything's just right here. Everything I need is just right here, and then that here's gone. So it is confusing. You know, you everything you said. I was saying, not just that I've been through that. I still go through all that. I don't feel I make any progress in this, although changes happen, strangely enough. But you still have, I think that's just the human condition. We bounce in and out of different kind of modes. If nothing else, this practice lets us bounce a little more lightly, dance through it rather than get so hung up on it when we're stuck. So that, for me, is one of the values if there's a reason to practice.
I wonder if there's really any point to talking about zazen. I mean, do we say anything important?
I don't know if this is an answer to that, but I found your Dharma talk very wonderful, because maybe when I'm in a Dharma talk where I feel really present and I don't find myself mentally trying to follow a line of thinking, I wonder at it. Because usually when people talk, I find myself hooking into a mental place and trying to follow their line of thinking. And for me, the most rewarding Dharma talks that I've been to have been talks where, although someone's talking, it's like the words are unraveling constantly, so all I can do is be in the present the whole time. And I end up at the end having no idea what was said verbally. But I feel like I've been delightfully in the present the whole time. And that's how I felt with your talk. Thank you.